And now for something completely different.
It's a rich man's world. Forget everything you've been told by others before. Get ready for the real deal. The full story. The whole enchilada. The Lance Roberts Show. It's money, markets, life. Now, it's the Lance Roberts Show.
It's 6:06 on this Thursday. It's a pre-Friday Eve edition of the Lance Roberts Show. And getting ready to wrap up the week.
Mm-hmm.
And also getting ready to wrap up the month. Labor Day right around the corner.
I know.
So
I've got and it's getting cooler in the evenings.
It is getting cooler in the evenings. We actually sat outside last night, just kind of hung out for a while. It was very nice. So are you getting ready to put your white pants away for the for the summer?
Yes, along with my patent leather shoes and the white belt.
Yeah, exactly. I know the John Travolta look, just, you know.
It was horrid.
You're getting a little bit old for that now.
Well,
so is John Travolta, by the way.
Trying to stay young.
There you go. But, yeah, we are getting ready to wrap up the month. Hard to believe, about to slide into the last quarter of the year already. You know what that means? Christmas. You know we're getting close.
Hey.
So, you know, I told you we recently moved.
Yes.
Into a new house. So my wife is a very sentimental woman. And holidays are very important for her. So
my wife listens to Christmas music year round.
Well, okay. My wife honors the holidays in order. Okay.
Oh. How so practical.
Exactly. So, you know, she has decorations. You know, her big thing is to decorate for the holidays,
yeah.
Whatever holiday is, right? So we have all these Halloween decorations. That's coming up here shortly.
Well, you don't have a Labor Day wreath?
Don't have a Labor Day wreath. I'll have to work on that with
okay.
her. But we do have inflatable turkeys for Thanksgiving because she honestly believes that turkeys get a short stick for Thanksgiving because nobody decorates or does anything for Thanksgiving other than just eat turkeys, mm-hmm. right? So we go slaughter turkeys. We don't honor them in the process. So, yes, we have inflatable turkeys that go outside
our yard.
House. Yes. Well, look, this is why, you know, you've been with me for years now that, you know, we always try to find turkey music to play.
Yes.
There's not a lot of good turkey songs to play for Thanksgiving
there's
holiday.
There's no turkey polka.
Yeah. Exactly. So, anyway, so we moved recently, and my wife's in a sheer panic right now because apparently during the move, they lost her Christmas trees.
Really?
Yeah.
Wait.
Trees.
Yes. Plural?
Trees, plural. She has little ones. She has a big one for the living room.
Yeah, the
right?
main one.
She has little ones for each of the kids' rooms.
Peripherals.
Yeah, exactly. So
that's hilarious.
She's very upset, though, because now, honestly, our tree was getting a little bit old, right? There was
long in the needle?
A little bit long in the needle. So I'm wondering, I'm actually starting to question myself, did it actually get lost or was it terminated?
Have you quizzed the kids?
I haven't yet. But I think this may be a ploy on her part to get a new Christmas tree.
Those trees may have been shipped to Germany with Tommy.
With Colton. Tommy's still in high school.
Tommy.
He would like to be
in
Germany.
The thought still applies.
As school has restarted, he would like to be in Germany.
Praying for Germany.
I will tell you a funny story, though. So my son, if you don't know the what's been going on, what we're talking about here, my oldest son... graduated high school, and he got an apprenticeship with a company in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
It's a handgun company, very famous, to go work on. He wants to learn how to be a gunsmith. That's what he wants to do. So he was very excited about graduating high school and getting this apprenticeship. And this is the way it works in Germany, by the way. When you graduate high school, most everybody goes into apprenticeship, and then you learn a basic skill set, and then you go into college. Maybe it's something we might want to think about here.
What a concept.
So he was all excited about this. He's like, man, I hate school. I never have to go to school again. I'm out of high school. So I told you, we've talked about this for a while now, that the immigration policy to be a working member in Germany is very difficult.
Like to get a German green card.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And to get that is not easy. Oh. You have to do all kinds of qualifications. And not only do you have to have a sponsor family, which he has, he has to have an approved apprenticeship lined up. He's
mm-hmm.
got that.
Mm-hmm.
But he has to now go to school for 6 months to pass an A, what's called an A1 proficiency test, because you have to be able to read and write in German.
That's great.
Yeah, no, it's something that we should think about here. Yeah. You know, we talk about all this immigration, and it's great, but it's a very strict policy. And he's already received letters from the German government that if he doesn't have, you know, this document and this document by a certain date, he has to leave the country.
Was he able to read the letters?
Yes. He took 4 years of German
here.
No, he's fine.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, no, but they have a very strict policy, and they will come get you and deport you out of the country.
Wow.
So, you know,
So there really is a grammar police.
There really is a grammar police. And here's what's interesting is that I'm not going to go there.
I know. I was very careful with that one.
Yeah, we'll just leave it at grammar police.
Yeah.
But here's what's interesting. If he would go apply as a refugee,
really?
He could actually stay in the country.
A refugee from Texas.
Well, he'd have to go claim he's a refugee from Trump.
Is that a thing over there?
It is honestly a thing. He spends most of his time defending President Trump from the German people that the citizens that he talks to. Because they go out to dinner and stuff. Yeah. As soon as they find out he's American, what do they want to talk about?
Boom.
They want to talk about President Trump and what's going on. And so it's just a million questions. I get emails and Skypes almost every day. It's like, what do they mean by this? I'm having to explain basic economics in a lot of cases, but you know, he's just bombarded by these by these questions about Trump. And so, you know, the interesting thing is that despite the populism of President Trump here in the United States, it is a very different view everywhere else in the world. And it has a lot to do with media, right? How the media portrays things and how it's written and those type of things. But it's a very different, and I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm just saying that there's a very different outlook about the U.S. and about our policies and politics right now than when I was living over in Germany. I lived in Germany for about a year and a half. I lived in Switzerland for a year. I lived in France for 3 years. I lived in London. This was way back before the turn of the century, just so you how old I am.
Back in the olden days.
Back in the old days. We saw horses and carriages and all those type of things. Back then, the biggest news topic was the fact that I had snakeskin boots, and that's what they wanted to talk about.
Ooh.
That I was from Texas, and they wanted to know whether or not we all had cattle and oil wells. So
snakeskin, that was cowboy boots.
But back in the 90s, that's what was important. Today, it's all about politics. And just to show you how social media has changed the world. Anyway, hey, I got some stuff to get into this morning. Michael Leibowitz will join us here at 6:30 to talk about the Federal Reserve. Of course, Jerome Powell at Jackson Hole, Wyoming right now for the annual confab of economists. So we'll be hearing a speech from him later on today. What will he say? Will he basically kowtow to Donald Trump and talk about cutting rates and doing QE, or is he going to hold firm to his guns? We're going to talk about that today. When we come back, we're going to talk about Pavlov's dogs. Don't go away.
Want a longer talk with Lance about your money? Request a personal one-on-one at LanceRobertsShow.com.
Speaking of how money works and how to make the most out of Social Security, we do lunch and learns here at our office. And on September 4th, that's the Wednesday, at 12 o'clock, we're doing Social Security Basic Rules and Claiming Strategies. This is one of the more seminal, basic, but important lunch and learns, because all we focus on are those basic rules and claiming strategies for Social Security. So if you're thinking about taking Social Security or you're a couple of years away, whatever it is, we provide lunch. Just go to realinvestmentadvice.com, check out the events calendar, and sign up.
And welcome back at 6:17 this morning as we kind of get the show underway. Coming up at 6:30, like I said, Michael Leibowitz will be joining us, talk a little bit about the Federal Reserve and what Jerome Powell will or will not be saying today, because this is really what everybody's looking forward to at this point, which is, you know, what's going to be said, what's that's going to mean. But the issue of rate cuts and more QE is an interesting issue in and of itself, because there's a lot of evidence going back historically about training people to act in a certain manner. Classical conditioning, which is also known as the Pavlovian or the respondent conditioning process, is a procedure in which a potent stimulus, and in Pavlov's case, that was the food, was paired with a neutral stimulus, which was a bell. And what happened was, what Pavlov found out was, is that as he would ring a bell for his assistant to take food to feed the dogs. And, well, after a while, every time he rang the bell, the dogs would immediately start to salivate because they were expecting the food to show up. Now, the reason I bring this up is this is now what has happened to investors over the course of the last decade. Zero interest rates, lower interest rates, and quantitative easing have now provided that stimulus, that conditioning to investors. So as soon as somebody talks about lower rates or quantitative easing, it must mean buy stocks, because over the last decade, that's what's happened, is that stock prices have gone up every time that we've done stimulus into the markets of some sort or another. And this is what President Trump believes is the case to be as well. It's like, hey, our economy's doing great. If we just had zero interest rates and more QE, then our economy would do even better. Well, first of all, there is a more than enough evidence of looking at the economy and the cost of what has been done in terms of QE, et cetera, in terms of creating economic growth. So, for instance, with wages, you know, we spend about $10.83 for every dollar's worth of wage growth that was received over the course of the last decade. Full-time employment costs $19.48 for every one job. You know, this is, you know, the trade-off of what we're creating versus what we're getting is not really a beneficial measure of the effectiveness, or at least suggesting that the effectiveness of QE actually works. So if you begin to step back and look at, you know, when QE was working, right? So we lowered interest rates to zero and stock markets took off. But remember what was going on in the markets at the time. Confidence of consumers was near record lows in 2009, 2010. Today, confidence is near record highs. Importantly, when we look at quantitative easing and zero rates, the money flowed into the stock market most assuredly, because that liquidity that was generated went into the financial markets, because that was the easiest place to gain a return on those dollars for the big Wall Street firms, for pension funds, etc. The problem was it didn't really translate down into stronger economic growth. It didn't really transfer down into higher wage growth, etc. So in fact, so if we take a look at this, and even corporate profitability for that point. So since 2007, okay, which was the peak of the market previously, between the peak of the market in 2007 and today, the market's up about 103%. So the markets have effectively doubled since 2007. Yet, from that same period, corporate profits are only up 19.7% on an after-tax basis, and economic growth is only up 22%. So the point here is that while, yes, there was a massive increase in asset prices because of quantitative easing and liquidity hitting the markets, it all stayed bottled up within the really kind of the top 10% of the economy. It never really filtered through. And this is because the transmission system of the economy was broken during the financial crisis. Normally what should happen, and this was the belief that the Federal Reserve had at the time, was that by doing quantitative easing and putting this liquidity into the banks would then lend that out to individuals who would go start businesses and buy homes and do all these type of things. It just never happened. Monetary velocity within the economy has collapsed, and that is your transmission system. Monetary velocity should have been increasing for the last decade instead of going down. And yes, we did see some, you know, pockets of recovery, but not to the extent of what you have expected for $4 trillion worth of liquidity coming in from the Federal Reserve, not to mention another $28 trillion in all other types of government programs. If you take a look at the $33 trillion that we put in, the return on that investment has been basically nil for the amount of growth that we've gotten in the economy. You know, it's arguable that if we had done nothing, right, if we hadn't bailed out the banks, if we hadn't done anything, that the economy would have still recovered. Now, the market wouldn't be up, you know, 300% from the lows, but there's a reasonable argument that the economic growth and employment growth that we've gotten would have occurred anyway, just simply of what happens following an economic recession, right? During a recession, you kind of blow everything out, and then you recover and you grow again. So, again, it's that transmission system of moving money from the central banks to the banks to the individual consumer that never really occurred, and which is why we never really saw booming rates of economic growth. You know, and it's interesting because we talk, you know, the media just recently was talking about 3% economic growth. That's awesome. 3%. 3% is low, right? I mean, we were growing at 4% prior to the financial crisis. We were growing at 6% prior to the turn of 2000. So, you know, we're growing at a very, very low rate of growth, and we're excited about whatever growth we can get, but it's costing trillions of dollars worth of liquidity just to create a very low level of growth that effectively is really more tied to just the population growth itself. If the population grows at 2% a year, your economic growth is going to grow at about 2% a year. That's just a function of population growth and increased demand on providers. So when you go and look at all these things, there's really very little evidence that any of this is actually occurring to provide stronger growth, which is what the president wants. He wants lower rates, and he wants more QE to create more economic growth, but there's no real evidence that actually occurs. The other problem is that doing quantitative easing and lower rates. Now, by the way, let's just step back for 1 second. Zero interest rates and quantitative easing is what you do in the event of a recession or a financial crisis. That's not what you do at the peak of an economic cycle. So if we take a look at where we were economically back in, 2009, as an example, January of 2009, you know, the 10-year Treasury was running 2.5%. Nominal GDP was -1.75%. The inflation rate was -0.12%. Unemployment was 7.8%. Jobless claims were 543,000 a week. Very, very negative numbers really across the board. Take a look where we are today. You know, you've got record low unemployment. You've got record low jobless claims. So everything now is completely the opposite of what it was back in 2009. So you're going to hit the system with this life support, right? This is like the patient is laying on the doctor's table in surgery, and they pull out the paddles to restart the heart, but the heart's still beating. So if you hit a beating heart with an electroshock, it does the exact opposite effect of what you expect. It stops the heart from beating. And that's the real risk that the Fed is running. And they know, and the Fed knows this. And this is why there's a real risk here that, and we'll talk about this with Mike here in just a few minutes, is that the real risk here is that ultimately, you know, the Fed may try to hit the system with more liquidity and it doesn't work. And that becomes a real question. We're talking about Pavlov's dogs here a second ago, is that investors have become conditioned to say, oh, low interest rates, QE, stock prices go up. But there's an old saying on Wall Street that says nobody rings a bell at the top. But what if, as an investor and as somebody that has money at risk in the markets, when you take a look at the fact we've got an inverted yield curve, which has historically preceded economic recessions and slowdowns, when you have a deterioration in small cap and mid cap stocks, when you have a deterioration in stocks outside of the U.S., in other words, every other market in the world is deteriorating with the exception of the S&P 500, what if the bell that's being rung is not the bell of quantitative easing and the bell of rushing in to buy stocks, but what if this is the bell that's marking the top of the market for this particular cycle? And that's the question that investors need to answer. It's also the question that the Fed has to deal with. You know, one last point here is that keep a watch on oil prices. There's a very high correlation between the direction and trend of oil prices. And here in Houston and Texas, we know this more than anything else. But there's a very high correlation between economic growth, inflation, and interest rates relative to economic growth and oil prices. And if you pay attention to oil prices are telling you, along with small cap and mid cap stocks, along with stocks outside the U.S. and outside the S&P 500, all those indicators are telling you that there's something wrong within the economy. Yet investors are focused on the bell in terms of trying to make their financial decisions. Quick break. We'll come back, talk more about this with Michael Leibowitz, CFA, right after the break. Don't go away. Let's go!
Lance Roberts Blog. It's required reading for the informed investor. Catch it today on LanceRobertsShow.com.
Speaking of how money works and how to make the most out of Social Security, we do lunch and learns here at our office. And on September 4th, that's the Wednesday at 12 o'clock, we're doing Social Security basic rules and claiming strategies. This is one of the more seminal, basic, but important lunch and learns because all we focus on are those basic rules and claiming strategies for Social Security. So if you're thinking about taking Social Security or you're a couple of years away, whatever it is, we provide lunch. Just go to realinvestmentadvice.com, check out the events calendar, and sign up.
I want to be the very best. Like no one ever was.
And welcome back to the show this morning. It's 6:33 as we get things going on this Friday Eve edition of the show. Get ready to wrap up the week. Thank goodness. It's been another one of those weeks. Michael Leibowitz, CFA, joining me this morning to talk a little bit about Jerome Powell and, of course, what's going on now with the Jackson Hole meeting. Every year, economists and the Fed governors from all around the country, they all meet in Jackson Hole, Wyoming for a two-day confab to talk about really kind of the state of the world. They all get a few minutes of press time to come out and give speeches and talk about their views on different things. And so kind of all eyes are going to be glued to Jackson Hole for the next 2 days. Not for really anything other than just hints or clues about whether or not the Fed will cut rates and how fast they'll cut rates and by how much they'll cut rates. And will they actually restart quantitative easing? In other words, the stock, bond buying by the Fed, will they start that process again? So I said Michael Leibowitz joining me this morning to talk a little bit about that. So Mike, you know, it's interesting where we are right now because the president has come out very vocally and just this week saying the Fed should cut 100 basis points and restart QE in order to ensure a strong economy. But yet the reason that the Fed does QE and the Fed does, you know, lowers interest rates towards zero is because of emergency measures. You use those type of tools to offset an economic recession, not necessarily throw gasoline on a burning fire, right?
Right, right. We're still at what I would say are emergency levels. Right. The Fed's balance sheet is still four so times what it was prior to the financial crisis. And Fed funds rates are lower than they ever, you know, they've been here for a decade. They've risen over the last few years, but they're still at levels that are like the lowest in history. Mm-hmm. So we are in emergency policy mode today. And now they're talking about adding to that. And, you know, we talk about this a lot, Lance, that the economic environment is certainly slowing, right? Europe's slowing, China's slowing pretty quickly, it looks like. But our economy's holding up. Retail sales have been decent. And they're already talking about adding to emergency policy. And I think that tells you a lot about not just where we are today, but where we've been for the last 10 years and how stimulus has been used to prop up and avoid, mm-hmm. or at least so far avoid, a lot of the pain from that should have occurred 10 years ago.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting as you talk about retail sales. And again, just recently, you know, we just had kind of numbers out on consumption. Target and Lowe's reported very good earnings here. Of course, it's interesting because they beat earnings, but those earnings have been lowered dramatically so that they could beat those earnings numbers. And then, you know, everybody's all excited because they beat numbers, which means obviously that the retail consumer is still very strong. But if we take a look at retail sales data, if we take a look at personal consumption expenditure data, everything that really relates back to the consumer, yes, it's still positive, but it's all running at about half the rate of where it was in 1999 and lower than it rates where we were prior to 2007. And if we look at retail sales on a per capita basis, we actually have been running negative rates of retail sales growth over the last decade. So, you know, we're excited that the numbers are positive, but we have to put these in context of where we've been in previous expansionary periods. And this, by all measures, is the weakest economic expansion ever on record for the United States.
Right, right. So let's think about why. One of the main reasons that is occurring is because over the last 20 or 30 years, we have constantly borrowed to consume.
Mm-hmm.
You know, corporations have borrowed, the U.S. government has borrowed, and citizens have borrowed to consume. And we have borrowed more than our incomes have grown. And as that has occurred, it puts us in a position where servicing the debt of yesterday, as well as taking on new debt, requires lower and lower interest rates, and it's less efficient, it's less productive. And that's the point we're at now. And what's the answer? The answer is we have to lower rates so that we can incentivize everyone, you know, whether it's citizens, corporations, or the not necessarily the government, but citizens and corporations to spend more, to boost economic growth. And at the same time, we're killing our productivity, and we're just making the problem worse in the long run.
Well, I think that's an interesting point that you bring up because, you know, we've done a lot of studies on this. We've done a lot of research on this. I've written a lot of reports on the issue of debt, both consumer debt as well as corporate debt, which is now at all-time records. We're, you know, all-time record consumer debt. We've got all-time record corporate debt. We're pushing, you know, and we're pushing record levels of government debt as well. I mean, so, you know, everywhere you look, debt is rising. And yet there's a lot of conversation talking about, well, you know, rates are ultimately going to go up. Well, the problem is if rates – we saw what happened. Rates went from 0 to 2.5% or 2.25% on the Fed funds rate. Housing stopped, autos stopped, you know, the 10-year Treasury yield got up to 3.25%, and you thought it was the end of the world that was occurring. And immediately, you know, the president starts coming out and starts talking about lowering rates. Now, this is the same guy that's, you know, president of the United States that prior to his election was chastising Janet Yellen for creating a big, fat, ugly bubble for keeping interest rates too low for too long. Now, he wants to keep the bubble going by putting rates back down to zero, because if rates do rise at all, you cause a debt catastrophe across pension funds, mutual funds, government issues, personal issues. I mean, just about everywhere you look, if interest rates tick up too much at all, you're going to have a real crisis on your hands.
And I would add to that, that whatever rate that was that rates got to, whether it was mortgage rates, two-year rates, 10-year rates, mm-hmm. corporate rates, whatever that rate was a year or so ago when yields hit their local high levels, right. It's lower today than it was then because there is more debt.
Yep. Well,
and steadily going down.
Right. And so how do you get out of that problem then? I mean, because here's the risk, right? We're going to talk about something a little bit esoteric here, and we'll try to do our best to explain it very very basically, so you can really understand the impact of this. The government is running a $1 trillion deficit right now. In the last part of this year, the Fed's going to have to issue about $400 to $800 billion worth of new debt because they've got to make up for the previous debt issuance that they were accumulating up to the point that they actually passed this continuing resolution, which will also increase spending by not just the 8% annual increase in spending, but by another $320 billion of spending. And that's going to be on top of the deficit we already have. So the government's got to issue all this new debt. And here's the problem that Mike and I have been talking about for a while. You're going to issue $1 trillion worth of new debt over the next year, and there better be a buyer for it. Because if there's no, if a buyer doesn't show up to buy that debt at 2% interest rates or 1.75 or whatever the 10-year treasury rate is selling at, if nobody shows up to buy that, that yield's going to go up to 2 or 3 or 4% to buy buyer to find buyers, and that's where the problem occurs. And that's the real risk here, right?
Right, right. There will be a buyer. It's just at what rate. And most likely, whoever's buying it is selling something else to buy it. So it's, I would think of it as the opposite of QE. QE, they were taking securities out of the market and affecting the supply and demand for financial assets, and not just treasuries. It really had an effect across all financial assets. Well, they're doing effectively the same, the opposite. And it's not the Fed, it's the Treasury, but they're having the same effect. They're draining liquidity, and it will be intense for the next 3 or 4 months in combination because the debt cap got extended. And because the borrowing needs are now just, I think it's 1.3 or 1.4 mm-hmm. trillion is the deficit over the next 12 months.
And that's low, by the way. That projected deficit is always wrong and it's always low.
Right, right. And keep in mind, in the years after the financial crisis, they were running 400, maybe 500. Mm-hmm. So we're almost running 3 times the rate, despite the economy doing about the same. And that, like we talked about earlier, that's bad productivity of debt.
Well, and this is the other, and of course, this there's one, I guess, positive, if you want to call it that, positive, is that the 10-year treasury here in the U.S., it's a, you know, it's kind of the global reserve bond of the world, so to speak, currently trading today about 1.57, 1.59% in interest, which is higher than nearly a third of all sovereign bonds around the world, which are now trading at negative yields. When we come back from the break, Mike, I just want to touch on this negative yield issue and why that's a bigger concern than I think most people give it credit for. We'll come back with the break. Mike Leibowitz right here on The Voice of Texas. I'm your host, Lance Roberts, right here at realinvestmentadvice.com.
Catch Lance Roberts' podcast later at LanceRobertsShow.com.
Speaking of how money works and how to make the most out of Social Security, we do lunch and learns here at our office. And on September 4th, that's the Wednesday, at 12 o'clock, we're doing Social Security basic rules and claiming strategies. This is one of the more seminal, basic, but important lunch and learns because all we focus on are those basic rules and claiming strategies for Social Security. So if you're thinking about taking Social Security or you're a couple of years away, whatever it is, we provide lunch. Just go to realinvestmentadvice.com, check out the events calendar, and sign up.
You know, there's a study out this morning. We need a good piece of heavy metal music.
Heavy metal music?
Heavy metal music. There's a study out that says that they surveyed a bunch of millennials,
yeah,
right, that are still in school, mm-hmm, studying, right? And they discovered that heavy metal music actually makes them more productive in terms of doing research,
really,
mathematics, those type of things. That heavy metal music actually stimulates the brain.
Me like this?
We're doing our thing. We're going to help everybody be more productive today at work.
Rock and roll!
Exactly. So put up your fingers.
Stick out your tongue.
Exactly. Bang your head. And just know that you'll be more productive today.
What could possibly go wrong?
Yeah. Michael Leibowitz usually starts out his day with classical. Good morning, Michael. Welcome back to the show. He does heavy metal classical. Actually, Brent, you're a big music fan. Have you watched the, I don't know what you call it, biography, but the story about Bohemian Rhapsody, the movie?
Oh, that movie. I have not seen the movie, but I'm familiar with
Freddie Mercury.
Yeah. Freddie Mercury and uh-huh. Queen. The guy that plays Freddie Mercury in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Is the actor that does Mr. Robot on USA, which is has been an acclaimed series on USA, but he does a phenomenal job. If he doesn't get an Academy Award for his portrayal of Freddie Mercury, I'll be surprised.
Or at least a nomination.
Right, he does. Yeah. But it's a pretty. If you're a fan of Queen, mm-hmm, and from their of their music and stuff, but it talks about how they got, you know, how where they came from and how they developed into what ultimately became the phenomenon of Queen.
Yeah.
So it's actually a pretty interesting story. Anyway, I digress. From Queen to negative interest rates. segue. So, Mike, just for the break, we're talking a little bit about interest rates, the Fed lowering interest rates. Of course, this is all surrounding this issue that over the next 2 days, we'll be hearing from a multitude of Fed governors talking about their views on the economy and on Fed policy. Esther George this morning already talking about the fact that she thinks rates are good where they are. We shouldn't be cutting them. I agree with her. Because you don't have a lot to work with here in terms of Fed rate cuts. So you need to kind of save all the ammunition you have for a recession. So when you actually get into a recession, you've got some ammo to work with. But when you look around the world right now, Mike, you look at government debt, sovereign debt, right? The debt of France and the UK and Germany and Spain and other every other country in the world, Japan. We have more negative. We have almost $15 trillion of debt now having a negative yield, which really suggests that there is something broken within the global economic system. Or am I misreading that?
No, you're exactly right. Actually, the number's 17. It was 15 like a week ago. That's how quickly it's rising.
Right.
And it's not just government bonds. It's a lot of investment grade corporate bonds. And even a few junk bonds are trading below zero.
Now
it's completely broken.
Yeah, and again, you know, and when you start talking about junk debt, this is debt that is most likely going to default. You should be paid a higher yield for holding junk debt because that's offsetting your risk of default. But yet, those are trading at negative yields. In other words, you're not only are you potentially risking loss of capital from not being repaid, if you hold the bond to maturity, you're also going to have a negative rate of return.
And Lance, I'm hearing that there are even some loan sharks over there that are giving money away at a negative interest rate. But that's the comparison, right? I mean,
so wait, how does that work? If a loan shark gives makes you a loan at a negative rate and you won't take his interest payment, does he show up and break your legs?
Break his leg.
So, there you go. But this is part and parcel of all of this, though, right? Which is, you know, these governments around the world, the ECB, and look, President Trump has noted this. He says, look, China's lowering interest rates and doing stimulus. The ECB's lowering rates and doing stimulus. We need to be doing the same thing. But that's not necessarily a good thing. Yes, it may make asset prices go higher, but there's more than enough evidence to suggest it's not improving the health and prosperity of the economy itself on a global basis.
Right, that's a great point. It's called stimulus, but it's not stimulating. Right? So you go back and you look at, you know, you made a comment earlier that they only have 2.25% of rates to cut, so don't cut now, save your ammunition. But there's an important question that no one's asking. It's how potent is that ammunition?
Right.
So when we were back in 08, dropping rates from where they're at now, 2.25 to 2%, would have been helpful on the margin because mortgage rates were hitting all-time lows. And as mortgage rates decline and decline, people refinance, people are more incented to buy a house. Mm-hmm. It creates activity in the real estate market. Today, the 30-year mortgage rate, I believe, is 3.8, 3.9, mm-hmm. which is the same level it's been at, give or take a little, for the last 10 years. So the fact that the Fed cut rates is not – it's helping on the margin. It's doing some things, but it's not nearly as effective. And well, that's the same thing going on in Europe and everywhere else.
Yeah, and I think also too – and I did touch on this before you came on the show this morning, but the housing I think is a great example of this, is that back in 2009 when the Fed cut interest rates, we went from 5.25% on the Fed funds rate to zero. So you dropped the Fed funds rate by almost 5 percentage points. And yes, mortgage rates came down because of that decline. But there was also a huge incentive for home buying at that point as well, because we had just gone through a housing market. People had been had lost their homes, were having to refi. We, you know, of course, we had programs to help people refi their houses and those type of things. So there was a lot of activity. We had blown out this market. Of course, we had a big rush of people coming into the housing market that were buying up houses to turn them into rentals. We saw major mutual fund companies like BlackRock and others start buying homes and creating REITs of individual homes that were turned into rentals. that doesn't exist anymore. That demand, you know, people that were going to buy a house have probably bought a house. There's marginal, you know, we have population growth every year that's leading to some demand to buy houses, but the but that big surge of demand is no longer available. So we may right. cut rates here. And again, to your point, if I cut rates back to zero and if mortgage rates are already at 3.8%, there is a limit to how long banks will loan money at what rate. And, you know, banks aren't going to loan, even if interest rates go to zero and stay there, even on the 10-year treasury, the 30-year mortgage is not going to go to zero. It's going to bottom out here somewhere where banks say, I'm not going to lend it for less than this for 30 years. I've got to at least adjust for inflation.
Right. There is a benefit, but it's not nearly as great as we've seen in the past.
Right.
And that's the problem. And that's what, you know, in Europe, so what if the rate goes from minus 0.60 to minus 0.70? If no one's borrowing money at minus 0.60, you're giving money away for free and it's not being borrowed. What makes you think it's going to be borrowed at even a cheaper rate?
Right. Well, and again, I think, you know, and, you know, we've talked about this before, but just to reiterate this point, you know, is that negative rates are a little bit deceiving because it suggests that banks are paying people to borrow money. And that's not actually what's happening. It's that people are buying bonds at a price where even though there's a positive coupon attached to that bond, they're paying so much for the bond that the yield to maturity is now negative. In other words, if you hold the bond to maturity, you'll lose money. Nobody's buying these bonds expecting to hold them to maturity. They're buying them expecting rates to drop sharply because of a global recession. They're going to make a bunch of money, then sell the bonds.
Right. I'm actually writing a piece on this now. One of the reasons, one of the only reason I can really think of to hold a bond other than safety, which I have issues with, is the greater fool theory.
Right.
The greater fool theory basically says you buy it because you can find a greater fool to buy it from you in the future.
And there always seems to be one.
Until there's not.
Until
and
there's
that's
not.
What we learned in 2008.
Well, you know, it's an interesting point because I just wrote an article today, and it's called Pavlov's Dogs and the Ringing of the Bell. And it's talking about this idea that, you know, investors have been trained over the course of the last decade to buy every dip, because when the market dips, there's been stimulus, there's been support from one standpoint or the other, whether it's the ECB doing stimulus or us doing stimulus. Over the last decade, there's been this repeated drive to push markets higher through liquidity and keep those prices elevated to spur consumer confidence, right? So we've now trained investors to buy the dip, you know, but this is not just because that's the way it is now. It's always been this way. Investors have always been trained to buy the dip on the way up, and you buy every dip until the one time buying the dip doesn't work. And that's the real question here, is that at some point, investors are going to come in, rush in to buy these things, expecting a greater fool, as you just said, to buy something at a higher price, and there's not going to be anybody there. And that's going to be the point that this whole thing turns. And unfortunately, by the time you realize that, for most investors, it's too late.
Right, right. When you really understand the economics, the interest rates, where earnings are coming from, and that there's not really great earnings growth, you really realize that many of these financial markets are based on the greater fool theory, and they will continue to rise, investors will continue to profit until there's not a greater fool.
Well, you know, and really when we talk about rising markets, I've got some charts in the article this morning. So if you go by our website, realinvestmentadvice.com, you can get Mike's latest article as well as mine, talking about Pavlov's dogs and this theory. But Mike, if you take a look at small cap, mid cap indexes, if you take a look at the global international markets, you know, ex-US, they're all down significantly. They're trending negatively. Really, outside of the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ, most of the other indexes in the world are showing real deterioration here, which suggests that really the economic environment is a lot weaker than it looks like, and that investors are becoming much more crowded into these mega cap names, which is always what you see at the end of a bull market cycle.
Yeah, I mean, the markets are certainly showing signs, but you know what? It can continue to rise on the back of 20, 30 stocks on the large cap stocks. Mm-hmm. We've seen that going on for a year now. I just saw a graph of the S&P versus the Russell, and the underperformance of the Russell, which is a small cap index of 1,000 companies,
right,
is just grossly underperforming the S&P to a point that it hasn't done so in, I believe it was 10 or 15 years.
Right. Which, and this goes back to our premise earlier, is that we've talked about this on the show, is that, you know, value investing, which is what investors should do, you know, buy value stocks, something cheap, is underperforming growth investing by some of the largest margins on record. You've written several articles on this. If you go to our professional site, riapro.net, riapro.net, subscribe free for 30 days. But Mike's written a whole series about this value versus growth dispersion and why that's going to be the next great investing opportunity when it reverses. That's on our professional site, riapro.net. Of course, you can get to all of our stuff directly through our website at realinvestmentadvice.com. Our latest podcasts, articles, videos, newsletter, it's all there for you. Of course, if you need help with anything at all, simply click the Ask a Question button. We answer every email every day. Always happy to help you. Realinvestmentadvice.com. Hang around because Chris Salcedo is coming up next. Realinvestmentadvice.com. We'll see you next time. Money, money, money. Always sunny in a rich password.